Thank you. Yeah, we're working. All right. Good morning. I'm glad to be here this morning with you guys. I miss this church a lot when I go to church in Joplin. It's quite different at the bigger churches that I go to down there. I also miss the weather. Like I was telling my mom, when I was driving back into town, it was like 80 degrees in Joplin, and I get back into Iowa, and it shifts like a 20-degree difference, and so I'm glad. I love having Octobers in the fall in this chillier weather, so yeah, I'm glad to be here. So I have to say, in preparation for this message, I was a little bit nervous. I wasn't necessarily nervous about actually standing up here and talking to you guys as I was so much as just of preparing the message and writing the message. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that, as you can see, I'm preaching out of 1 Kings. I did take an Old Testament class at school, but it was when Jason asked me a couple months ago at the end of summer. He's like, hey, I was just wondering if you wanted to preach on the 15th in the middle of October. And without hesitation, I don't know why it was without hesitation, but without hesitation, I said, yeah, sure, no problem. And then I was just going to pick a passage to preach on. And when I got back to school, I spent hours and hours and hours trying to figure out what am I going to preach this message on. And I had a couple ideas in mind, but I just could not quite figure out a passage. And so finally, I texted Jason back, and I said, you just give me a passage, because like I'm just in this exegetical mood from Ozark, and so I'm just like, just give me a passage that I can take and just roll with that. And so he said, how about something from the Old Testament? And I'm like, all right, I could probably do something with that. And so he gave it to me, and he's like, well, how about the 1 Kings chapter 19? And I had no idea what 1 Kings chapter 19 was until I hung up the phone and I looked it up, and then I texted him back. I'm like, yes, I like that. That'll work. But what I'm getting at is I became just a little bit nervous. And the way that I showed my nervousness in writing this passage was I spent, maybe 5 or 6 hours at the library that night reading commentary after commentary, trying to build this message. But it was during that time that I realized somebody else became quite nervous, and we'll get to that in a second. The book of this passage, like I said, I wasn't really sure what to think of this until I started looking into it. And I just want you guys to keep this question in mind as I'm giving this message: is just, have you become nervous? When I say nervous, I'm not necessarily talking about those butterflies that you get in your stomach, like the feelings that you may get when you see a certain guy or girl, specifically to the junior high and high schoolers. I'm not talking about that kind of nervous. I'm not even talking about the kind of nervousness that I felt when I was preparing this message, but I'm talking about the kind of nervousness that Elijah felt in this passage. So if you have your Bibles with you, turn to 1 Kings chapter 19, and we'll start. We'll start in verse 9. 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 9. I think it says in your bulletin 13 through something, but I'm not sure. 13 through 16. We're starting at verse 9. There he came to a cave and lodged in it. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? He said, I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I only am left, and they seek my life to take it away. Have you ever become nervous? I think Elijah is just a little bit nervous in this passage, but like I said, it's not that nervousness that I think that most of us associate that word with. Elijah's nervous about a couple things in this passage. He's as you can tell, he's not really in the best state of mind, but he's nervous about a couple things. He's nervous and in a state of depression about all of the idolatry taking place and worried that the people of Israel are completely disregarding everything that God has set in place for them. Elijah's also nervous about his own life. You can see in that last part of that verse, he feels that he's alone and he's scared that the Israelites are hunting him down to kill him, which They are. I mean, he has a right to be nervous. If you know anything about the book of 1 Kings, specifically chapter 18, chapter 19, you know the events that come before chapter 19. If not, I'll just go through them real quick. So Elijah killed a lot of men. I'll just put it simply. And when I say a lot of men, does anybody know the exact number? I'm curious. Anybody? No? 450. That's a lot. That's a lot of men to just, and it actually says in the end of verse 18 that he, with a sword, I mean like execution style, 450 men. Now in Elijah's defense, the men were prophets of Baal. Elijah was just following the law that was put in place against false prophets that you can find in the book of Deuteronomy. If you're interested in looking that up, Deuteronomy 13 and chapter 17 kind of goes through some of those laws. But this act nonetheless put Elijah in a lot of danger. And I think it gave him a right to be just a little bit nervous. You know, when he was on Mount Carmel in chapter 18, when this interaction with him and these prophets took place, he was definitely at, you could say, a spiritual high. I mean, that was when God rained down fire on the altar, and afterwards he just took these prophets of Baal, and he's like, it was basically a victory story for God in the Old Testament. And so you could say that he was pretty much on a spiritual high, but it wasn't until after all of that happened that he all of a sudden just went straight downhill, as you can see in the passage that we just read. So he became a little bit nervous. We're going to turn back a little bit and actually look at chapter 19, verse 4. And this is kind of where Elijah's journey starts after this experience that he had on the mountain. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat under a broom tree. This is Elijah that we're talking about. And he asked that he might die, saying, "It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my fathers." Elijah asked God to kill him, to take his life away. That was in the state of desperation and the state of nervousness and of anxiety that Elijah was in. Have you ever been nervous? Elijah calls out to God saying, "It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my fathers." Out of complete and utter despair, Elijah calls out to end his life. You've all heard of the phrase rock bottom. Elijah, at this moment, you can't read this passage and not think, Elijah's at that point in his life. He's at this rock bottom. He's depressed, wishing he could die. He won't eat anything. He has a tremendous amount of self-pity. Now, when I was researching this passage and I came across, I started really understanding how Elijah was feeling and why he was feeling these things, it kind of makes me wonder a little bit. Here's a thought. Isn't it kind of interesting how what triggered Elijah's response and what triggered his emotions during this time, what made him kind of spiral down into this rock bottom point of his life, of this depression, anxiety, nervousness, and it was all over the thought of God's people straying away from what he set before them. Like, can you imagine talking to Elijah at this time? Like, hey, Elijah, hey, man, you know, what's wrong? Oh, you know, just the thought of Israel's apostasy. What are the things that get us down? You know, like, you look at Elijah, and he's completely to the point where he just wants to die because the nation that is supposed to be a nation of God all of a sudden isn't. It's just a thought. It's just a side note. But that's also what I love about this story. The story in 1 Kings, the story of Elijah. Like I said, when I went into this story, I didn't really know much about it. But one big thing I think you can pull from it is it shows just how weak man is. You know, like you look at Elijah, you read the Bible today, and you read all of these stories about prophets and about these just incredible men of God, and you're like, you can't compare my life to these guys. These guys are, you know, these guys do incredible things for the work of the kingdom. That, you know, God speaks to these guys vocally, shows them miracles, all of these things. You can't compare what I'm going through with that. But look at Elijah. That's what I love about this story. You can seem like you have it all together, be a true man of God, but even a man like Elijah, one of the greatest prophets in the Old Testament, can still look up at God and just say, I'm done. And it kind of just brings that whole concept of that we have of these heroic Bible figures kind of to a more personal and relatable level. And so that's what I love. That's what I love about this story. After Elijah, he's sitting under this tree, and if you keep reading the verse, I'm not going to read it for you, but if you keep reading the verse, basically what happens is an angel comes down to Elijah, talks him up a bit, gives him some food, and he continues on his way. When I say continues on his way, I think the passage says like he walked another 40 days or something before he came to the cave where he dwells that we'll get to. So yeah, he a little bit of food it brought him up a little bit, gave him some energy. So after this period, he comes to the cave at Mount Horeb, and that's where we see him in the passage that we're in today. Now, if you know anything about places in the Bible, you know you might have heard of Mount Horeb. It's a pretty significant spot, actually. You might also know it as Mount Sinai. Does anybody know what happened at Mount Sinai? Yeah, that's where Moses, back in Exodus, received the law from God, received the Ten Commandments. God showed himself to Moses and, you know, up on top of the mountain and gave the law that we know of, gave Moses the law. So you can say it's a pretty important spot. But I also think that Elijah knew where he was going when he went to this cave. I agree with many biblical scholars when I say that Elijah probably decided to dwell here because this is where he believed he would have a pretty good chance of coming across the presence of God based on what happened with Moses. You know, Elijah was familiar with Moses and knew what happened at Mount Sinai. And so he's like, you know, I'm just at this point in my life where I just don't know what's going on. I just need to go somewhere where I can be in the presence of God. And so I think he kind of had a good idea, good plan on where he was going when he ended up at Mount Horeb. He really felt like he had nowhere else to go except a place where he could possibly find and hear the voice of God. That sort of sounds a lot like us, doesn't it? But I'll get to that in a minute. First, let's take a look at what Elijah goes through in this cave. So if you look back at verse 10, Elijah's explaining his current situation to the Lord. Now, after his situation's heard in verse 11, the voice tells him to go stand on the mountain outside of the cave before the Lord. Now, when I first read this, I was a little bit confused, because I thought the whole point of this passage was to hear God's voice, right? I mean, that's like, if you've ever, I'm sure you've probably heard a sermon on this passage before. It's pretty popular story. And so when I first read this interaction, I'm like, why is Elijah all, what, like, why doesn't the story just end there? Like, God spoke to him and just told him to go outside. Like, why was that not enough for Elijah? I thought that was the whole point of this story. But I think one of the main reasons why Elijah came to the cave was to come into the presence of God, to hear his voice, but I don't think in that way. Does that make sense? I don't think he came there, and when he all of a sudden was just lying there in his pity, and God just whispers to him in verse 11, let me find my spot here, in verse 11, he said, go out and stand on the mount before the Lord. I don't think when God came to him in this soft voice, now keep that in mind, God also came to him in this soft voice in verse 10 where he says, what are you doing here, Elijah? But I'll elaborate more on that in a moment. But I don't think this was the way that Elijah wanted to hear God speak. And so I think that's why there was a second part to this story. I think to understand this interaction, we need to remember Elijah's current state. He was in a state of manic depression, nervous for his life. He wasn't coming out of this cave on his own. He came to see God, feel God, and hear God, but not like the way that is represented in that first interaction. So what ultimately brought Elijah out of the cave? Well, let's keep reading verse 11. And he said, go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord, and behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, the sound of a low whisper. Sounds kind of familiar. There's a book that I set over here. You know, I like this passage a lot, but I don't want this to sound bad, but I think the Bible could have maybe explained this situation with just a little bit more passion. When the author of this book wrote this book, I didn't think he could have explained this. I'm not used to having a mic on my face. When this presence of God passed by, I think they may have been able to just elaborate on that a little bit more. But lucky for us, there are people that do a ton of Bible study on these types of things. And I have a book that I found in the library at my school, and it's a really old commentary, I think like turn of the century. And anyway, in this book, the author goes through this story with, I think, a little bit more passion. So I'd like to read this to you from a different perspective. We're starting when Elijah's out on the mountain and the events start happening. First, a great and strong wind rent the mountains and break in pieces the rocks before the Lord. The winds of God which blow there they list, and we know not whence they come nor whether they go, have in them so awful and irresistible a strength that man and the works of man are reduced to importance before them. And when they rush and roar through the gullies of innumerable hills in tropic lands where the intense heat has rarefied the air, the sound of them is beyond all comparison, weird and terrific. We cannot wonder what this roar of the hurricane was regarded as, the trump of the archangel and the voice of God at Sinai, or that the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and appeared to Ezekiel in a great cloud and a whirlwind out of the north, or that Jeremiah compared his anger to a whirling and sweeping storm, or that the psalmist describes him as bowing the heavens and coming down and casting darkness under his feet and flying upon a cherub and walking upon the wings of the wind, or that Nahum says, the Lord hath his way in the whirlwind and the storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet, and the mountains quake at him. And Elijah felt the terror of the scene as the storm dislodged huge masses of the mountain granite and sent them rolling and crashing down the hills. But it did not speak to his inmost heart, for the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind and earthquake shook the solid bases of the Sinaitic range, the mountains saw God and trembled. The Lord, in the language of the psalmist, shook the wilderness of Kadesh. The mountains skipped like rams and the little hills like young sheep. And man never feels so objectively helpless. He is never reduced to such absolute insignificance as when the solid earth beneath him, the very emblem of stability, trembles as with a palsy and cleaves beneath his feet and shakes his towers to the earth and swallows up his cities. Once more, the soul of Elijah shuddered at the terrific impression of this sign of Jehovah's power, but it had no message for his inmost heart, for the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake of fire, Jehovah overwhelmed the prophet's senses with the dread magnificence of one of those lurid thunderstorms of which the terrors are never so tremendous as in such mountain scenes where travelers tell us that the burning air seems transfused into sheets of flame. In that awful muttering and roar of the lurid clouds, that millionfold reverberation of what the psalmist calls the voice of the Lord when the lightnings light the world and run along the ground. And in the language of Habakkuk, God sends abroad his arrows and the lights of his glittering spear, and burning coals go forth under his feet. The lips of man quiver at the voice, and his heart sinks, and he trembles where he stands. And this, too, Elijah must have felt as the hiding place of God's power, and yet it did not speak to his inmost heart, for the Lord was not in the fire. Can you imagine what Elijah was going through after reading it that way? I think it's incredible. And I think what's another interesting thing is the last time that Elijah had, I think God was kind of just messing with Elijah when he sent the fire, because when was the last time that Elijah had, the last time that Elijah encountered God was in fire at Mount Carmel when he rained down fire on top of the mountain. And so when Elijah saw the fire, he was probably like, oh, there's God right there, because I just, you know, a little bit ago, I saw him on top of Mount Carmel in fire. So that's got to be God, but it wasn't. So I think God was just kind of playing on Elijah's humor there. I think that if Elijah was looking for God, he probably would have found him as soon as he felt the heat of the fire that began to warm the entrance to the cave. But the text says that the Lord was in none of those things. And if Elijah wasn't completely thrown off yet, I'm sure he was at the end of verse 12. Let's keep reading right here. And after the earthquake of fire, but the Lord was not in the fire, and after the fire, the sound of a low whisper. Sound familiar? That's how God originally started talking to Elijah, when he first got to the cave was in a low whisper. Let's continue reading, verse 13. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, there came a voice to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Did you catch that? He wrapped his face in his cloak. Now, when I first read that, I'm like, oh, it's got to be because, you know, there's just, it's got to be kind of dusty out there, you know, after all of this. He just needed to cover his face. No, I think it's because at this moment, Elijah knew God was out there. And whenever you see an encounter with God in the Old Testament, what does that person do? They cover their face or they'll die because they can't look God directly in the face. So I think this act of Elijah covering his face with his cloak, I think at this moment, this was a symbolic moment that Elijah knew God was out there. And he's like, I better cover my face for this. He found out that God does not always appear in powerful and miraculous events. If you get nothing out of me standing up here today, get this. Just because we serve a mighty God does not mean he always shows up in mighty ways. It makes you wonder if maybe God was trying to tell Elijah the same thing. Like, hey, Elijah, I'm trying to talk to you in a way you need to be talked to. The beginning, when he was in the cave, that first soft whisper. So please listen to me. But because you didn't, now I'm going to make you think I'm coming in all of these things. But that's just to get your attention. And you know, I find this passage just as much a story of healing as I do a story about hearing God's voice. Because we know that the first time the Lord speaks to Elijah in the cave is when he asks the question, what are you doing here? But I think Elijah answered that question the wrong way. Elijah answers with the story of how he got to the cave, why he's in the cave. But I think Elijah answered it in the wrong way. I think what the Lord was asking was not, why are you in this physical place at this moment in time? But rather, why is your spirit broken? Why is your mind in the place that it is? Why are you in this current state? Why are you here? And I think we answer that question wrongly a lot too. It was asked in a gentle way to coax a man who is in a sensitive state out of the cave. He's afraid to leave, but didn't realize it because the God I know does not appear in this way. He appears in mighty ways. So God had an idea. He'll send these events, wind, an earthquake, a fire, because he knows that will get your attention. But just when you think you have found God, he doesn't appear in any of these, but rather a soft voice, because we serve a mighty God, but that does not mean that he only shows up in mighty ways. Have you ever felt the nervousness as Elijah? And if so, where did you try to find God? Where were you looking for his voice? Remember, I said we'll come back to that in a minute. Well, here's the minute. Earlier, I mentioned that. Well, when faced with opposition in our lives, when our minds are in a state much like Elijah's, when we feel like we have no hope, we have a tendency to gravitate towards our own caves, if you will, much like Elijah did. And the places that we go in order to find God's presence, these caves, I think we treat as our churches. It's a place where we believe God is present, where I can hear God. I mean, you know, even, you know, you read stories or you watch movies, which I obviously you don't, I'm not saying that that's correct, but all I'm saying is you see these examples of people that may not fully believe or may not be Christians, but when they go through hard times in their life, they go to a church. Why? Because they know that whether or not they believe that, whether all of that aside, they know that it's a place where they think they have the best chance of hearing God's voice. And there may be some of you here today in a state much like Elijah. And you're sitting in a pew waiting for God to show himself in some mighty, some majestic way. And to those of you who are like that, I say this. God knows exactly how you need to be spoken to. So don't rule out the power of a soft voice.